Hi, everybody. This is Ryan Geelan, one of the producers of the Bloodstream podcast and the co-founder of Believe Limited. Patrick is on his way to El Salvador right now with the World Federation of Hemophilia, producing a short documentary series about WFH's work in that nation. Before we start this month's Bloodstream, I want to take a minute to acknowledge the life of an extraordinary bleeding disorders community advocate, Barry Hardy, who passed away last week. Many of you knew Barry from his tireless advocacy work, crisscrossing the country to attend what seemed, to me at least, to be every big bleeding disorders event. He did a panel for us, actually, for our Powering Through program at HFA in 2016. It was my first time meeting Barry and hearing about the inspiration for Wheels for the World, his fundraising platform. The Wheels for the World campaigns allowed Barry to combine his love of cycling and his mission to raise money and awareness for people with bleeding disorders by cycling across the country. Over the last few years, Barry raised several hundred thousand dollars during these Wheels campaigns, money that went to supporting bleeding disorders communities in developing nations around the world. There are incredible photos of Barry on his Wheels trips. In several of these pics, he's holding his bike over his head, having completed one of his cross-country rides. Take a minute and look up these photos. If you haven't seen them shared all over Facebook the past few days by Barry's friends and so many who looked up to him, take a minute and Google them. Barry was an advocate, a friend to many, a hero to those who benefited from his rides. Barry was extraordinary. He was a survivor. This is from Patrick on his way to El Salvador. Thinking about Barry today as the Believe team sits at the airport en route to El Salvador with World Federation of Hemophilia, Barry's Wheels for the World cycling adventures raised tens of thousands of dollars for Save One Life, changing the lives of who knows how many families affected by bleeding disorders. Barry's death is terribly sad for many reasons, but I'm keenly aware that the developing world community lost one of their most prominent influential advocates. We can't allow his loss to become a loss for them as well. It's up to all of us to do a little more in his honor, whatever that means. And Patrick continues, I'm going to put together a Remembering Barry Hardy special episode of the Bloodstream podcast, composed of community stories about Barry. If you'd like to contribute a story to this project, please leave a 2 to 3 minute message on our Bloodstream voicemail. Please include your name, where you're from, how we can contact you, and your story or remembrance about Barry. The voicemail box to call is 1-866-758-7902. Again, that's 866-758-7902. If you missed the phone number or want to see links to Barry's work, take a look at the show notes on your podcast app or on the website bloodstreampod.com. And I'm just going to let this music fade out for a bit. And we'll start the show in a second.
Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Shire, and for that we say
thank you, Shire.
Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream podcast, episode 21, February 19th 2018. I'm Patrick James Lynch,
and I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, we discuss how one executive director in China has creatively given hope, dignity, and income to her patients. We take you through how to stay fit and healthy while traveling this year, and we introduce you to a brand new game here on the BS Pod. That's going to be a lot of fun. Plus, Hannah Lutz shares her story of life with type 3 von Willebrand disease, and Michael Hargett, the hemophiliac who lost a whopping 280 pounds and became the first person with hemophilia to undergo a heart transplant, joins us as today's interview guest to discuss his remarkable journey. All that and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. Welcome back to the Bloodstream podcast. Natalie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Yeah?
Yeah, happy to be back to the podcast and back in New York.
What have you been up to since we last spoke to you here on the Bloodstream podcast?
We had a family vacation.
We did. We went to Costa Rica. Yeah. That was nice. Very nice. Saw monkeys and stuff.
Yeah. And iguanas.
Giant flying grass. What, a caterpillar? What was it? Not caterpillar.
Grasshoppers.
Size of like a pterodactyl.
Toddler.
Pterodactyl, what I was actually looking for, the prehistoric dinosaur.
Yeah.
That right?
They look like flying pterodactyls.
They were gigantic.
Yeah.
It should be illegal to have bugs that large in the world. Who oversees that?
And then what did you do after that?
I went away again to Australia, which sounds really fun, but it was just really long hours in an editing room working on Bombardier Blood. We got our festival rough cut together of our 95-minute documentary about this hemophiliac mountaineer's historic attempt to summit all the highest mountains on each of the seven continents. Something like that. I stumbled over it. Listen, it's written way better. The important thing is that it's written down well, and I can stumble over it now. But yeah, so I did that. That was fun. Very intense, but really cool to see where that film is at. And I can't wait to be at the part where we're sharing it with the whole community. I'm excited. You've seen the rough cut, so you know a little bit about what's going on now.
I have.
I kept you away from it for a very long time.
I know. And I'm happy for that. I'm happy I got to see it now. And it's
near final stage.
Yeah.
So good stuff. Some fun updates going on with us and going on with Believe Limited. Couple things that I want to just kind of shout out here right at the top before we get into the meat of the episode. A little bit of a follow-up from a story that we covered previously about the ongoing legal dispute between Shire and Roche Genentech over access to Heme Libre. We've talked about that in the previous episode. There's been a lot about that on social. But it does speak to a greater point about access to medication and access to services. So I'm inclined to read this statement from the Hemophilia Federation of America, HFA, about their Project Call. So I'm just going to read their statement directly here. If you have been denied service or had to file an exception for your medication, been forced to fail on a product before being allowed to use the product of your choice, mandated to use a pharmacy that is not meeting your needs, or forced to go through a lengthy pre-authorization process, we want to hear about it. By participating in Project Calls, CALLS, you can help us make a case for change. So HFA is aggregating all these stories of challenge either to getting your medication or to getting services that are meeting your needs. So if you have experienced one of those things, or if you feel like you have been barred or excessively challenged from something that you need to take care of your bleeding disorder, respond to Project Calls. We have a link in the program notes, or you can go to HFA's website and take a look at Project Calls. But this is a very important effort, Project Calls. Within Believe Limited's world, our award-winning comedic web series, Stop the Bleeding, about a dysfunctional bleeding disorders nonprofit organization, produced a four-minute video that takes viewers on a guided tour of our show's fictional Hemophilia Treatment Center, or HTC, and it essentially answers the question, what is an HTC? I'm really proud of this video. I think it's fun and lighthearted, but also it's super informative about what's the basic composition of your average HTC. And we like it so much that we created a website so it could live in isolation and be really easily accessed. So the website is htctour.org, and there you will find our four-minute video about HTCs and what exactly they are. Hope you like it. If you do, please share it. Some podcast updates for you. We got a great response to our Ask the Expert podcast from last month with Dr. Guy Young on inhibitors, Heme Libre, and the history of inhibitor treatment. If you haven't yet checked out that episode, I highly recommend it. Make your way over to bloodstreammedia.com and click on over to the Ask the Expert podcast. The latest episode, or the February episode of the Ask the Expert podcast, featuring Rich Pizzillo, the executive director of the New England Hemophilia Association, who is on to talk about advocacy and community engagement, will be available on Monday, February 26th. And two updates with that podcast. We have now secured a sponsorship from Bayer. So thank you very much to Bayer for believing in and supporting the Ask the Expert podcast. You're going to hear more about Bayer and their interest in the podcast and services for the community on the Ask the Expert podcast. And we have a new host, Chris Bombardier, the hemophiliac mountaineer. Blah, 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 blah. He is going to be the new host of the Ask the Expert podcast. You may have heard him on the episode with Dr. Young doing a little bit of an introduction. He takes over. The first interview with Rich did go very well. It's in the can, so to speak, already. So we can say with security that Chris is one for one. in his podcasting host life. So check that out, February 26th on the Ask the Expert podcast. New episode of the Powering Through podcast from this month is already out, came out February 5th, and features my one-on-one conversation with renowned advocate Jeannie White-Ginder. At this point, I don't think she needs any more introduction on this podcast. But an announcement for Powering Through podcast, we have a new host starting there as well. Next month in March, Heather Robb, a multi-talented creative artist, singer, songwriter, screenwriter, actor, etc., and a longtime friend of and now part of Believe Limited, is the new host of the Powering Through podcast. So I will obviously still be hosting the panels that are featured, but she will be the actual podcast host, kind of leading you through the podcast experience of listening to those panels and crystallizing the takeaways. So that will be on Heather's plate starting in March. So three reoccurring podcasts, three different groups of hosts, four hosts in total. How about that? And then next month as well on our Bloodline series of podcasts, not to be outdone by the other two or the other three, the Bloodline series is piping up because we have a new three-episode series on and about young adults with hemophilia. It's built from a roundtable conversation that Natalie and I co-facilitated last month in January in partnership with the Hemophilia Association of New Jersey, where we discussed things like transitioning from high school to college, from college into the workforce, navigating dating and relationships with hemophilia, and much more. So keep an eye on Bloodstream Media to learn more about the release of that first-of-its-kind series next month, Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. And speaking of awareness, you like what I did there, Natalie? See that?
I saw it.
You did? Okay. I don't like your tone.
I don't know if I liked it.
I can tell. Well, I want you all to be aware that we are now on Spotify. So you can now subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast, Ask the Expert podcast, Powering Through podcast, and the Bloodline special series of podcasts on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever it is you listen to podcasts. You can also follow the links at bloodstreammedia.com to subscribe to our pods on your podcast player of choice. At the time of this recording, we have 50 episodes that we have recorded across all four of the podcasts. In fact, this right here is number 51. So pretty cool. If you haven't yet partaken, you're falling behind. There's 50 episodes you got to catch up on. So go over to bloodstreammedia.com or subscribe on Spotify or your player of choice. And finally, you can keep up with us on social, facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, at bloodstreaminfo on Twitter. And as always, send us your feedback, ideas, or submit your short essay for consideration as a future share segment by emailing mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. All right, now for our brand new game here in the Bloodstream podcast. We used to have a headline segment where there, go ahead, say what you're ready to say.
Boring.
Thank you, Natalie. It was kind of boring. And I always thought it was important to try to get as much news out as possible on this thing. But, you know, going on for 8 minutes with just a relentless amount of just names of companies and products and legal stuff is kind of
boring.
So what we've come up with is this idea of community news in 60 seconds. And it's quite simple. Natalie and I have a timer set for 60 seconds, and we've got a list of about 15 different headlines, short explanations of stories here. We're going to run through as many of them as we can in 60 seconds, and then at the end, wherever we stop, that's the end. But all the things that you hear here, as well as those that we don't get to, there will be links in the program notes for you to click on and read on more about at your leisure if you so choose. We're just going to give you a little taste here in community news in 60 seconds, because if it went for any longer, it would become
boring.
Natalie, is the timer ready?
It is.
Okay. Community news in 60 seconds starts now.
Washington Day is the Bleeding Disorders National Advocacy Effort, and D.C. is taking place March 7th through 9th.
Likewise, the NHF's Bleeding Disorders Conference, formerly known as Annual Meeting, will take place October 11th through the 13th in Orlando, Florida. Registration is now open.
The Patient Access Network, PAN, Foundation has opened a new patient insurance premium assistance program for individuals with hemophilia.
Nice recovery. A study recently published in the journal Blood titled Sexual Health in Patients with Hemophilia, the Insights from the Patient-Reported Outcomes, Burdens, and Experience Probe study found that hemophilia does interfere with patient sexual activity and is linked to worse health status.
My Life, Our Future, to be featured in the CDC Public Health webinar on February 22nd.
That one's too short. On February 1st, the National Organization for Rare Disorders, NORD, kicked off their 7,000-mile rare movement bike, run, walk challenge intended to raise money for the research into 7,000 rare diseases that affect at least 30 million Americans.
Novo Nordisk recently announced the availability of Rubinin, the company's recombinant glycopegylated product for the treatment of adults and children with hemophilia B.
10 seconds. Bio-Ferrata, the manufacturer of Eloctate and Prolix, has been acquired by the pharmaceutical company Sanofi for $11.6 billion.
Europe's Committee for Medicinal Products for Human Use, CHMP, recommends approval of of Himri Libert.
That is it. That is it. That is the end of our news. Nothing else shall be spoken about here. That is Community News in 60 Seconds. Again, you can find links to all those things that we said, the thing we almost said, and the things we didn't get to in the program notes from this episode. And if you have something that you would like to submit to us for consideration on next month's Community News in 60 Seconds, you can email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. All right, moving into the like, share, comment segments for this month's episode, kicking it off, as always, with our like segment brought to us by Natalie. Natalie, what lovely little story do you have for us today?
It is an article about how to fit in exercise while you travel.
Sounds impossible. Don't believe it can be done. What else you got?
I just think it's appropriate for this time to 7-8 weeks into the year where New Year's resolutions fall off. You know, you missed a couple days. Life got busy.
Why even bother anymore?
I mean, that happens.
I know.
Yeah. But it's only February. Don't let that happen. So if you have a business trip or a trip for pleasure coming up and you've really kind of had a routine at home, there's ways to work it in that don't include necessarily having to have gym equipment or go to a gym. Annette Lang, a New York City-based certified personal trainer, said you can actually maintain and even improve your fitness level when you're on the road and you don't have to even bother with a gym to do it. So some of her suggestions...
You know, just a real quick too, that's a good point about like there's those who have maybe fallen off and the ideas that are in here are ways that you can incorporate fitness into your... You don't even really have to be traveling, right? It's just like a kind of ways you can incorporate it into your day-to-day life in general. But for those who do, because I fall victim to this constantly, for those who do set up routines at home, travel disrupts all that stuff. Your diet, your sleep, your exercise, everything. Travel disrupts everything. So being able to find a way to maintain it, maybe not by doing what you do at home, but by implementing tools like she lays out, it'll make sure that if you have stayed on the horse and you haven't given up your New Year's resolutions, but you're about to travel this year and your routines are about to get thrown, this is a way that you can maybe, you know, bridge that gap in between periods where you're at home and doing your routine.
Yeah, and I think when you have laid out a routine for the first several weeks of the year and you're really going crazy, you know, there's this mental... kind of dissonance of like, okay, well, I couldn't go to my 45-minute spin class, so like today doesn't count. And it's right. Like, that doesn't have to be true. You can make today count when you're traveling. Her first tip is to experience your environment through activity. And, you know, that's opting to do things, you know, like maybe if you're going to a place that has an observation deck, take the stairs as opposed to the elevator. A lot of cities now have bike shares. Mm-hmm. So instead of hopping in a taxi when you're somewhere, you know, take the bike share.
Wear a helmet.
Yes, wear a helmet. Safety first. And that too, like if you have some leisure time and you're exploring the city and there are places, museums you want to go to, restaurants, bars, shopping, lay them out on a map, open Google Maps, drop some pins and see, and make it a walking tour, you know, walk from place to place.
Build in some breaks if you need them, you know, build in little breaks for a coffee or whatnot if it's going to be a couple few miles.
Yeah.
You know, build an opportunity, you know, do make it work for you, but customize it to make it a walking tour.
Where you're getting your steps in. And then she has another tip too, which is to start your day with a mini workout, just 5 minutes. You can set a little alarm on your phone.
What's the benefit of a quick workout like that in the morning?
Well, high intensity is really good. It gets your heart rate up and it jumpstarts your metabolism for the day. So if you pop out of bed and you set an alarm for 5 minutes and you do squat thrusts and jumping jacks and sit-ups and, you know, anything.
Or like
really.
Even like one of those for 5 minutes, right? Like the idea is just to kind of get your heart and your metabolism jumpstarted for the day.
Yeah. I mean, you'll break a sweat if you try and do any of those, any combination.
For 5 minutes. Yeah, that's a long time, actually.
Yeah.
5 minutes of jumping jacks is like, that's Herculean.
Feel very long.
Yeah, I won't be doing
but that it gets you going for the day.
Right.
And you've already elevated that heart rate.
Mm.
And another thing in this, whether you're on vacation in Disney World or you're just waiting in the grocery store line, is don't just wait in line. You can do all these micro exercises, calf raises, even just deep breathing.
Micro exercises. That's a good one, too. We know about micro bleeds. These are micro exercises.
Micro exercises. Yeah. Calf raises, glute squeezes.
It's funny. You see people doing this kind of stuff in line. I see this in like grocery stores, short lines, and it's always somebody who looks healthy. You know,
yeah.
Like I don't know, these people are strangers, but they look healthy. And I'm like, oh, this is a really efficient way to keep working out.
I try and do calf raises when I brush my teeth.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, smart. Smart. So I try to take the stairs instead of the elevator when I can. That's about as good as I can.
But yeah, just changing one or two things, you're going to burn some extra calories in the day, and
yeah,
you're going to keep that that good routine that you've established for 2018.
Which also mentally keep you feeling a little more accomplished. You know, if you're able to not, especially bridging gaps in between a routine of like, this is what I do with these ideas that you can maintain while traveling. I know for me, when I've done this kind of stuff during traveling, it just mentally, obviously the physical health impact is great, but mentally it just helps you feel that connection and that momentum to a lifestyle change, as opposed to like a quick sprint where, oh, I'm exercising all the time and then I stop. Exercising and then I stop. You know, being able to bridge it with walking the stairs, doing a walking tour, calf raises, quad stuff at the grocery store, like that, it helps. It helps a lot.
Yeah. So.
Well, cool. That's an interesting article. Thanks for sharing. We'll have the links in the program notes, and looking forward to see what you bring to the table next month. This month's share segment comes to us from Hannah Lutz. She shares a piece that is titled Type 3 Girl, in which she describes how living with von Willebrand disease type 3 inspired her to become a nurse, and how meeting others with her exact diagnosis at the first ever type 3 conference last year influenced her community activism. Here's Hannah.
My name is Hannah Lutz, and I live in Houston, Texas. On the day I was born, mass internal bleeding caused by a simple vitamin K injection led to my diagnosis, von Willebrand's type 3, the rarest and most severe form of VWD. Thus began my journey with my bleeding disorder. Now, growing up wasn't easy. I dealt with many life-threatening hemorrhages in my joints, soft tissues, and GI tract, resulting in countless hospital stays. When I began my cycle, the word horrible was an understatement. I bled relentlessly for 6 years until the only solution was a hysterectomy at the age of 18. Because I spent so much of my childhood in a hospital, the nurses and doctors became my teachers and my friends. The positivity that they could instill in me was powerful. And that's not to say that every nurse that I encountered was a gem. I had some unspeakably bad nurses, but some remarkable ones as well. I told myself when I was about 7 that I was going to become a nurse. I wanted to have the opportunity to make a sick child and parent's day like some of my nurses had made mine. I am standing before you today with my scrubs on and a pediatric stethoscope hanging around my neck. Thanks to a lot of hard work, hope, positive thinking, and a sense of humor. I enjoy finding humor where it can be found, and the positivity in every situation, because without it, we get nowhere, right? Now, I don't want anybody to get me wrong. I have my days when I want to, and sometimes do, kick and scream. But those are temporary, and they fade. I just want to make a difference in my world, especially my bleeding disorder community. Until recently, I had never met anybody with my disorder before. That all changed last year when I was given a grant to go to the first ever Type 3 National Conference in Florida. The only way that I can describe it is it was like meeting people that I had met a long time ago or in a dream. It was like we had known each other for years. It was like meeting up with old friends. I will always cherish that experience, and I learned a great deal by attending. Attending that conference and connecting with my peers led me to create the Instagram account Type 3 Girl. This group of people may be small, but we have much to say. We and so many others with rare disorders have been through so much, and we have found that our common ground is humor. If we start from a place of laughter and positivity, there is nowhere to go but up. Having this disorder not only shaped my career, it shaped my character and how I view and treat other human beings. It taught me bravery to endure pain and embrace adversity, to find inner strength, to look different, to be different. It taught me that there was more to being a woman than what society tells me. I may be bruised, but I am not broken, and I can always find a reason to laugh.
There you have it, Hannah Lutz's share piece, Type 3 Girl. We just listened to it over here. Natalie, you just heard it for the first time. Lots to respond to there. What's your immediate take?
My immediate take is the on the day she was born, having a massive bleed from the vitamin K injection, because that is typically given to babies to help with their clotting.
And isn't it ironic, don't you think? Or is that one of those ironic or coincidental? Or I forget. But yeah,
That's irony.
That's right. I thought so. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Anything else send out to you from that story?
I also loved that she was influenced to her life's work from her experience in the hospital as a child. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always interesting when somebody either winds up becoming a clinician or gets involved as an executive director, or in some ways kind of makes their profession about giving back to the thing that they were benefiting from when they were growing up. The fact that the first type 3 conference happened last year. So type 3 von Willebrand disease, it's the most rare, it's the most significant form of von Willebrand disease. It has the most complications, as we learned from the Bloodline series on VWD, which for those who, like Hannah, are affected by von Willebrand disease, I would highly encourage you to go to bloodstreammedia.com, click on the Bloodline series, and check out the three episodes that we did on people with VWD, men and women, type 1, 2, 3, clinicians, patients from around the world. A really cool series, but there is so much variance, but type 3 is generally the most severe. So the fact that we now have had a first conference where people like Hannah could meet other people that have this thing, because most of them haven't met other people with type 3 von Willebrand disease before, is really, really special. And again, it reinforces the value of community events, community engagement, and meeting people who share your life experience, or at least, you know, a significant component of your life experience. So kudos to Octapharma, who put up the money to make that happen. And kudos to Hannah for going and for being inspired to create the Type 3 Girl Instagram account and to up her advocacy game. We'll have links to that piece in written form, as well as links to Hannah's social presence in the program notes for this episode. Thanks, Hannah. Now, this month's comment segment comes from a story that was published in Sixth Tone, which is harder to say than you would think. Sixth Tone, titled How Paper and Scissors Gave Back Dignity to Hemophilia Patients by Peng Malin. Peng Malin is the director of the Hemophilia Association of Chongqing, a 30 million person city in southwest China, and she's the mother of a boy with hemophilia. Unlike in the U.S., factor is scarce in China, and Peng identified that since hemophilia is not classified as a disability, that it's much more challenging for patients to find work and lead normal lives. So I'm just going to read this synopsis that I put together based on this this piece from Peng, which I think is really interesting, and then at the end, Natalie and I will kind of chat for a moment about what the significance of this is for our greater community. So in 2006, after meeting two other mothers of hemophiliacs, the three women founded the Hemophilia Association of Chongqing and immediately got to work advocating for more reasonably priced medication to treat patients. Sadly, shortly after founding the association, one of their patients killed himself. His parents had recently passed away, and feeling hopeless and uncared for, he took his own life. That made Peng realize that the social needs of hemophilia patients were as important to focus on as the physical and other medical needs. So to activate this new focus on social development, the association began teaching trades to families with the idea that it would enable them to earn more income and improve their lives. After unsuccessful attempts at teaching web design and esports competitions, which sounds cool, Peng drew from her childhood and began teaching traditional paper cutting. So in 2007, she started an introductory class with the goal of teaching patients and parents the skill so that they would make some money without having to leave their home. Peng acknowledges that while great progress was made in the first few years, it began to taper off, and the desperate, quote, hand-to-mouth way of life continued for many of the patients. More and more, she felt like, to use her terms, the head of a beggar's union, constantly going out to solicit donations and share the money among members who needed cash. She notes that this didn't help people with hemophilia live with dignity and confidence. Peng experienced a eureka moment regarding paper cutting. She applied for and received a patent to protect her big idea, and she doubled down on her efforts to rally community members to develop their skills. She did this by founding a paper cutting company called, and I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly, Jian, second word AI, which literally means the love of cutting, which is a nice little hemo pun there. Nice job, Peng. The employees of this company were now earning an income, which motivated them to become even more productive. And during business booms, employees began making between $320 and $800 a month, which for context, according to Numbeo.com, the average monthly salary in the city of Chongqing is around $800 a month. So at the upper end, they were making a salary with this idea that was on par with people in the city at large. In 2011, this is cool, Peng ushered in another milestone when a piece that she collaborated on with a former student was auctioned off in Beijing for nearly $24,000, the most expensive paper cutting ever sold in China at that time. 10% of all profits from the paper cutting go towards supporting people with hemophilia who want to start their own businesses. And Peng shares a story of a patient who wanted to try rabbit farming. And at one point, he was unable to do so through this effort. At one point, he was raising over 1,000 rabbits and making over $20,000 a year. And I'm going to read the final paragraph of Peng's article verbatim. Quote, "My experience with the Hemophilia Association, and particularly with Jian Ai, the paper cutting company, has convinced me that people with hemophilia can contribute to society in significant ways. If we write off people with this blood disorder, we are wasting valuable human resources and practically casting highly talented people as second-class citizens. I have witnessed firsthand how fulfilling it is for long-ostracized hemophilia patients to land jobs, earn money, and even start their own businesses. Like my son, who today makes a living from teaching, Gyukin, a traditional seven-stringed zither. Apologies on the pronunciations. All these endeavors allow people living with life-changing conditions to temporarily forget their disorder, refuse to be defined by it, and face life with greater confidence." You can read Peng's piece in total from Sixth Tone. The links are in the program notes. So obviously an inspiring piece. She's clearly an impressive individual. A couple things that kind of jump out to me. One, most importantly, I think the biggest takeaway from this is how one person in a position of leadership thought creatively about how to boost the economic lives of her patients, and in doing so is able to raise quality of life, give them dignity, give them hope, and also illustrate quite clearly how valuable they could be as human resources within a society, as she talks about in that final paragraph, which I think especially in developing countries where there's a struggle to get government support to purchase medication for hemophilia, make medication affordable, to be able to say, you know, look, yeah, it's all well and nice that a person can have dignity and confidence, but if we're just strictly talking brass tacks within a society, this is enabling them to become productive members who are actually contributing value to society rather than, as the government may see it, pulling resources out of society. So that's remarkably important. And then thinking creatively about how to do so and using, like, who would ever think paper cutting and using paper and scissors as a hemophiliac, like that's the way in to creating from home way of life. But it makes sense when you actually kind of hear it in this context and have someone like Peng, who's an expert in that, leading the way. So that's my biggest takeaway from this, that, you know, the ability to make people with hemophilia valuable parts of society, not just for their own self-care and you know, self-esteem, but also to point to society officials and say, look what we can do when we properly care for these people.
Yeah, and I think it's not making them valuable members of society.
It's enabling their value to be articulated.
Yeah, and I think that she does it so well, and her words that you read at the end were very inspiring. And, you know, I think it's really cool to see. I'm just always inspired by the mothers of this community who...
It's funny you say that. Keep going.
Who tend to, at large, think creatively to help the lives of their children and then often other children. And I know these are adults that we're speaking of, but...
Well, in some cases, I mean, you know, we don't... The piece doesn't get into the ages, but that point about the mothers... You know, and this is throwing no shade at any of the dads or the male leaders in the communities, but I am consistently impressed with the female community leaders when we go to countries with the WFH or Save One Life or through my own experiences here in the U.S. And there is also a little bit of a tradition of mothers getting together to form associations for their kids and for the community when they feel a lack of support. NHF was founded that way. The story of Megan Adidiron in Nigeria losing, you know, her son having hemophilia and no one knowing anything about it, so she started a society. This story with Peng and meeting two other mothers, and you know, you look at each other and go, "We got to do something." Starting a society. There is a trend, a historical trend and precedent for these mothers in particular to kind of be the leaders. And I guess it's not terribly surprising, but I think it is neat to just point out. And for a disease state that affects primarily men, it's interesting that the leaders and the foundational individuals throughout history have often been women, been their mothers. It's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, you can read Peng's piece in full on sixthtone.com. Links in the program notes. Hi, Natalie. What you have something to say?
Yeah, I was just thinking of a jingle, but...
Oh, tell us.
Well, for some reason, mm-hmm. I was thinking mm-hmm. instead of the farmer in the dell, the farmer in the shire.
How would that go exactly? Can you give us an example of the farmer and the shire?
The farmer and the shire. The farmer and the shire.
Okay.
Who makes our podcast possible? Not the farmer, but Shire.
Very good. Thank you, Shire. And thank you, Natalie. Beautiful song.
Thanks.
Moving into this episode's interview segment, Mike Hargett is a resilient member of our community with quite an inspiring story. You may have seen his name or his New Heart for Mike campaign pop up on Facebook in the past couple of years, or perhaps you saw one of his segments on various news outlets. Mike has a truly impressive story, so let's get right to it. BS Pod episode 21, my interview with Mr. Michael Hargett. All right, so joining me on the line here, we have Mike Hargett. And Mike, I'm going to pull directly from your website, newheartformike.com, to give people a quick background, because this sentence here is quite an impressive one. In the past 3 years, Mike has lost 280 pounds, was treated and cleared of hepatitis C he contracted from a blood transfusion when he was 2 days old, is the first person in the U.S. with hemophilia to receive a heart transplant, went through 7 months of kidney dialysis, and now successfully underwent his second transplant with Alicia's donated kidney. Mike, that's a heck of a 3 years. So we'll start with just kind of a broad question. How are you?
Well, thank you very much for having me. This has been an amazing journey. The past 3 years, like you said, it's been a roller coaster of emotion, but I'm here. I'm still fighting away. And now, like you asked, how am I? I'm great because not only do I have a brand new beating heart, I also have the ability to pee again, which is fantastic, being on dialysis for 7 months, which is my first pee was fantastic. It was kind of like the scene from Harry Met Sally, you know, in the Cat's Deli is exactly how that went down.
Right on. Well, good. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's kind of cliche, but when health is challenged, it is those quote unquote little things like being able to take a pee that suddenly become like, you know, the most important things, right?
Exactly.
So let's go back a bit. You know, the first thing about your story that strikes me is it's not the fact that you contracted hepatitis C, but rather when. In 1986, you know, that's kind of toward the end of the period that we generally think of when we think about HIV and hepatitis C entering the bloodstream and making its way into plasma-derived products. So I'm just curious to know for you, how has that kind of played an impact in your life? And I imagine you don't meet too many other guys, you know, in that 30, 31, going on 32 age range who also have had that experience. Just share a little bit about what hepatitis C has been like in your life, especially growing up.
Totally. Yeah. So, you know, obviously had the bad blood transfusions back in the 80s, and then I was contracted with antibodies in 92. And then in 96 is when the virus went active, and I just kind of dealt with it and lived with it for a while. Kind of got sick off and on, but for the most part, it stayed dormant. I did have a lot of cirrhosis on my liver, but not enough to validate to have a liver transplant, because as everybody knows, it's one of the most complicated and complex transplants. and being a bleeder, that didn't really go hand in hand. And so before any of this could happen with the heart transplant and then the kidney transplant, I had to get cleared because no institution anywhere would look at me for a transplant with the Hep C on board. And so I rallied, and my cardiologist actually at OHSU, he rallied, he went down and submitted all the papers himself with the state of Oregon to get the Harvoni drug cleared, because at the time Medicare wasn't paying for it. And so he did what he had to do, submitted all the authorizations, the prior authorizations and things. And in 2012, I started the 3 month, one pill a day with the Harvoni. And within the first 2 weeks, I was undetectable. And then I finished the 3 month course, and I've been undetectable since 2012.
Well, congratulations on that. That's magnificent.
It is. It's very cool that I'll never have to deal with that ever again. And the irony is because I cook for a living and graduated from Le Cordon Bleu in Portland, got my degree in that. And so that's being that I work in a kitchen and I play with knives, that the irony is that if I cut myself, you know, then I have to expose and tell whoever that I have Hep C, and I'll no longer have to do that and never have to disclose that ever again.
Did you have a relief on that psychological level when you had cleared Hep C that was maybe, you know, as important to you as the physical benefits of having cleared it?
I think the emotional part is even more important than the physical, because you're right, you know, that the stigma that comes along with any of that is just gets us such a negative light. And no matter what you say, that even if, you know, for whatever reason, they think it's, you got it from not the right sources, and people, you know, getting the spotlight and the knowledge that needs out there that, you know, I didn't sit on a dirty toilet seat, I didn't do things, you know, that caused that. This is from something that I had to do for a life-saving treatment in order to treat my hemophilia.
So then 2014, you find out that you are in need of a life-saving heart transplant, but as a result of, there's complications and watchouts related to the hemophilia, of course, but then also your weight. And as I'd mentioned at the top, you know, you've lost 280 pounds. I think I had read somewhere, correct me if this is wrong, that at your heaviest, you were just north of 500 pounds, 505?
Yeah, 505 to be exact. Yes, sir.
All right. So it's 2014. You're told this about the need for a heart transplant. You're told that the weight, the hemophilia are going to be complications. What starts going through your head?
Yeah, that was a tough time. Because not only did hemophilia play a part, but at that time, hemophilia was kind of like on the back burner. You know, I'd lived with it for my whole life, and it was kind of I knew that was kind of the less amount of my problems, but it contributed because no one wanted to look at me to be evaluated for a transplant, because when they hear hemophilia, it's just like the brakes kick on, and they don't know what it is, because, you know, either they read a little chapter in med school and that's all they knew. And you end up, you know, I'm sure as you know, that you end up teaching the doctor sometimes more about hemophilia,
right?
Because you have to be your own advocate. And so being that I did need a transplant, one of the first things that I had to be a BMI of 35 or less. And so I quit my job. I moved back in with my parents and I started working out full time. And there was no secret. You know, I basically ate less and moved more. So when I was able to get the weight off, it took me a little over a year to get started, and then 2 years to get finally the rest of it off. And then I went to a lot of different counseling because I had to do a lot of counseling for emotional eating, because that was the biggest thing for me, was because I had no control over anything else in my life medically. The only thing I did have control over was my eating.
If we could stay on that for a second, because I think that's really an interesting moment, because whether it's eating or abusive drinking or isolating oneself, there are these behaviors that are actually symptomatic of something emotionally profound that's happening. And, you know, it's stating the obvious perhaps, but step one is being able to identify, where is this coming from? Why am I doing this thing that I know I shouldn't be doing? Like, rationally, I know it's not the best idea for me to eat two entire pizzas. I'm speaking about my own prior experience, by the way, with that reference. I've been in that boat. And of course I know that that's not a good, healthy decision, but I'm doing it anyway. Why? Did you know that your overeating was connected to this emotional need to control, or was that something that you had to discover in this process?
I had to realize that I had to take more control back into my own, and not that, you know, I was told my mom, we had to change the relationship, that I needed that adult relationship with my mom and not the caregiver relationship that I had when I was, you know, 10 or 12. Once we swapped that and changed, and I basically let her know that, you know, now that I'm grown up, that she needs to let me use those tools to advocate and, you know, basically let me live my life. And one of those things was to realize that anytime that my parents took me up to the Hill, OHSU, where I go see all my docs, that afterwards, whatever happened, good or bad, information-wise, we would always go celebrate with food. And so then once I realized, once I got into counseling and realized that counseling, you know, even counseling has such a bad rap that, you know, that you go to a counselor, you know, you're weak or you need help with something. No, counseling has been a huge advocate and a huge part of my life in all aspects. You know, I have so many different counselors because so many different specialties. You know, I spent a good year in a counselor that specialized in emotional eating. And that really got to the root of why I ate. And it turned out that it was more that when my parents split when I was a kid, that had the roots of me kind of spiraling. And then with everything I couldn't control with my health, then I turned to food. And so once I got that down, now, you know, I haven't overeaten or emotionally ate or even gone through a drive-through. I had to figure out ways to turn into other things. So like I love playing the piano. I love racing gas-powered RC cars. I love now with the weight loss, I love being outdoors. I can't sit in front of a TV. So I love to be out and active because at my worst, the ejection fraction, where the fraction of where, how well your heart pumps, the normal is like 80% for you. When I was at my worst right before transplant, I was down to 4%. So I could barely even just get out of my bed to go to the restroom and back into my bed without feeling like I'd walked a marathon. And now I just had my previous echo and I'm at 71%. And that right there, that is better than any amount of money or lottery winnings because I have my health and I can walk. Like I'm walking almost 10,000 steps a day. And I thank God for my donor who checked his box to be an organ donor because I am still here today.
Wow. Yeah. That a lot in what you just said. So I want to kind of stay on the weight loss part for a second because I think and actually I was just chatting with my wife not too long ago about how this is the part of the calendar year where, you know, people's New Year's resolutions, if they haven't abandoned them already, they're getting really challenged right about now, or people are doubting themselves. You know, 2018, we're in it now. We're not in January anymore, right? And I think what can be intimidating, I used to joke, you know, you'd see the infomercials on TV about the latest piece of exercise equipment, and they would show you one of the most fit human beings you've ever seen with 2% body fat who's using this machine. And I always used to think, they're saying this is a brand new machine. Clearly, this person didn't start working out at the time that this commercial is being produced. Forget this machine. What's that person been doing? Just tell me what they're doing. That person is the person. That's what's interesting. But it's also intimidating, right? Because for the average person, that just doesn't even look like it's something remotely attainable, realistic, or it can be disheartening as much as it can be inspiring. So I think for people to hear like how you go from 505 pounds to, as you said, in that first year, kind of getting started, like what's that work? What is that more incremental, more realistic work that somebody who is obese can think about doing so that the examples of fitness aren't, you know, necessarily these Greek god-looking people on funky, expensive machines, but like regular people trying to better their lives. Can you give a little bit of insight into what you did that was successful?
Yeah, totally. So I'm a huge motivational quotes guru. Like, I mean, I put in, post-it notes everywhere. One of the best ones is from Babe Ruth, and that he said that it's hard to be the person that never gives up. One of the things I learned was that people always told me, oh, just get in the gym and just do squats and just work it out. But that's not, attainable. And after one day of doing squats, then you need like 4 days to rest because your legs are like rubber. So the more momentum you get by setting small goals, the better you feel. And then you want to keep doing it because you keep hitting milestones. You know, people always talk about meal prep and how meal prep takes such a long time to do. So I started small, and instead of cutting up veggies and fruits, for snacks, I would just go to Costco and buy the fruit and the veggie trays and then just put those in baggies. I started small, and then I built up, and then I menu planned to be able to get people involved and have a huge support network. I think that's the number one thing people don't is when they don't know what to do, or they think that they want to turn to food, or they feel like they're going to dip Cheetos in peanut butter or whatever craving it is, to try to get, that you need to reach out. So that's why I call friends. I have specific friends that I call every time that I have a craving that comes on, and they know, and then they talk me through it. And then we either go for a walk or we go, which is so weird when we actually go to work out, because I crave working out now. I'm glad this is being recorded, because I never thought in my entire life I would ever say like I would enjoy working out. It's just and plus when you work out, you get that feeling, those endorphins going and the rush. But you don't want to put stuff in your body that's bad after you just pushed and you sweated all that stuff out. Biggest thing, is making sure that you have, you set yourself up for success, because that's the ultimate thing, is making sure that you have the tools. And once you get those, find other like-minded people, because there's so much stuff that's going on in the world right now that you need to take it day by day. And that's what, even if it's meal by meal or snack by snack, like just stay strong and get in a network. I do Weight Watchers now, because I still have to learn how to eat healthy, but I think more so is the support, because once you walk inside that room and you're with like-minded people, there's no judgment. Everybody gets, because we're all in there because we love food. I did not gain all my weight from eating too many celery sticks. I guarantee that right now.
No, it's true. And then I think, that connecting with like-minded people and people who can provide that support you need when you need it. I think it's good to underscore that as being a priority. You also touched on something else that jumped out to me, which was quitting your job to be able to work out and focus on your health for that year. And, there's conversations that happen about how a bleeding disorder and really a chronic condition of any kind has a financial impact on individuals and families. Of course, what exactly that impact is, it really depends on all sorts of things, right? But it strikes me when you mention quitting your job to work out, you mentioned moving back home and living with mom. But I imagine too that there was some financial considerations that you had to wrestle with when going through what was a necessary process for your health, but certainly not an easy one. Can you speak a little bit to that component of all this?
Yeah. So right when I turned 18, I had to, get on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, because, as with all the stuff that's going on, the factor isn't cheap. And so by the time I was in eighth grade, I went through my first lifetime insurance cap. And so that's when I had to fight to get on Medicare, because they didn't have any caps at the time. And being that I received Social Security, it's very, I'm grateful. I'm so blessed to be able to have it, but I'm so ready to work and pay into the system. I wouldn't have been able to do what I did if I didn't get on Social Security. And that, like you said, the financial burden of quitting my job, and yes, my mom helps me immensely during that year period. But I had friends and family who supported me. You know, I had people who, if they couldn't contribute financially, they would make meals for me, or they would take me out to restaurants to congratulate my success. And instead of going to restaurants, we would, you know, we'd go get a juice cleanse or go walk or just go sit and talk. And that was just foreign to me as well. Like, for me not to use food as a celebration, that was like a huge, I felt like that was like winning the lottery. That was like a breakthrough because I didn't turn to food. And so when I had to move back in with my mom, it was very bittersweet, but I know that once I figured out that I was worth it and that I needed to take care of myself because no one was going to do that for me. And I think a lot of the times, especially during with everything I was going through, it was easier to focus on other people's problems than my own. And once I just owned up to it and took that responsibility, and having my brother, who just had his first kid, so I was an uncle for the first time to my niece.
Congratulations.
She was my rock. Thank you. She got me motivated because I wanted to see her graduate from high school. I mean, that little girl is my whole life. I couldn't imagine life without her, and she gave me the strength, and she still does every day, because when she runs in and squeezes me and be able to put her arms around me, that's the best feeling in the world. I don't care. No money could ever replace that feeling. And that's why I do what I do.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. And that inspiration from within the family is really, really neat to hear. I have so many questions, and actually for listeners, Mike and I met briefly at NHF this year, but when I say briefly, it was kind of literally like a hello. So while I know your story from what's online, and, you know, we know a little bit about each other, this is the first conversation that we've had of any kind. So, just a lot of genuine curiosity on my part. But before I jump ahead too far, so we've talked a good bit about the weight loss now and a little bit about the support and the financial components of some of this. But when it came time to actually going under the knife, so to speak, I imagine that figuring out the way to treat your hemophilia and try to prevent against excessive bleeding was nothing small of quite a process. Can you give us a little insight into how you and your clinicians worked together to come up with a plan?
That was the craziest part. So once I hit the BMI of 35, I was deemed eligible from OHSU to have a transplant, but the caveat is that OHSU did not want to accept me as a transplant candidate because of the hemophilia. I was too high risk, you know? And so I went through 5 different institutions all over the country, and Cedars-Sinai in LA trained their entire staff for 3 months for me to come down to do the procedure. Once that got the ball rolling, it was so fast. And once that happened, my hematology team up here at OHSU in Portland conferred with them down in LA, and they came up with a plan. And I was on a constant drip of factor 4 days pre and 3 days post of the procedure. I went through almost 500,000 units of factor. I'd never seen a bigger drip bag in my life. The surgeon, Dr. Trento down in Cedars, he is the one of the best in the country. And I just have a good friend that told me, you know, you never want to be the first or the last person to do anything. But in this regard, I had to be. I had, you know, there was no other way. It was inevitable. I needed a heart transplant. And so in correlation between OHSU and Cedars, they came up with an amazing care plan. I bled less than 750 mLs of blood through the whole entire procedure. And then afterwards did a twice-a-day infusion for almost a week and a half. And then I went to daily infusions for 2 weeks after that, just to be as a precaution. I didn't have any residual side effects. I mean, I did have a little bit of bleeding. I had tamponade, which is the bleeding into the sac around the heart, because I got nicked during a heart biopsy. So they had to deal with that, and that was not the funnest part, but, you know, comes with the territory of being the first one, I guess. I just couldn't imagine the going anywhere else, because they really did their due diligence and they were so cautious. They were totally in my side. They asked me questions. They asked me if this felt right, if I was on board with the care plan, and I put in my input and I changed some of the things based on things I knew from previous procedures that I had done. So it was, I couldn't have asked for a better outcome in regards to the care plan and getting the factor, and the fact that they correlated the information and the care plan from my hemonc box that I've seen my entire life up at OHSU.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. And like you said, that one physician said, you don't necessarily want to be the first to have to go through something, but when necessity calls, it sounds like you want exactly this kind of coordination and expertise in your corner. And now you've set the precedent, and now people can look at, you won't be the last person with hemophilia to have to get a heart transplant, and you will be a case that is now referenced when this starts becoming something we see more often as hemophiliacs age and just generally encounter more and more health challenges than we have historically ever before. With the last couple minutes we have here, Mike, I would love for you to give us a little bit of a look to what you're up to these days. I think I had read or heard in one of the interviews you had done for one of the news networks about a heart-healthy food truck concept that I think you might be working on. But can you give us a sense of, now that you're on the other side, and I'm sure the ongoing health challenges don't stop just because you're on the other side of the transplants, but in terms of just long-term, your goals, your mission, now that you are on the other side of these monumental moments in your life, what are you up to?
Yeah. That's the thing that I'm looking forward to. You know, I feel like now more than ever, I am living my life. You know, I have a good friend that used to tell me that all the things I've gone through puts me on little commercial breaks, and I am done with the commercial breaks. And I'm so grateful because, for one, I can pee again, which is, like you said, when you can't do that, you take that for granted when you do that on a daily basis. I just have pee parties all over the time now. And it's just...
have a whole bunch of questions about that I'll just leave for off mic. Please continue.
Right, exactly. So just let your mind wander. So one of the things that I'm super looking forward to is, like you said, about the heart-healthy food truck and doing that, because not only in the hemophilia community, it's still trying to live a healthy lifestyle, but now more than ever is because I'm a heart and kidney transplant recipient, that I need to live a heart healthy and renal friendly diet. So one of the things I think is a great niche, that I think, because food trucks here in Portland are huge, and I want to start up a completely mobile food truck and get it it's going to be the first mobile rotisserie in Portland. And it's going to be focused on Mediterranean heart-healthy tapas, those small plates. And I'm in the process of finishing, when I started writing a cookbook when I was in culinary school, a heart-healthy cookbook. And so I'm trying to finish that and get that published. And OHSU is trying to work it in to give to their incoming CHF patients when they get diagnosed. I'm going to be part of their intake. And then on top of that, I'm also volunteering and being endorsed by Donate Life and working them into my truck, because I want to give 10% back to Donate Life, because I obviously wouldn't be here with this extra borrowed time if it wasn't for my heart and kidney donors. I'm just looking forward to feeding people and making sure that they can realize that heart-healthy food can still taste amazing and you won't miss the sodium. And am wanting to be a huge advocate for organ donation and trying to get this up and running to where I can travel the country being an advocate for organ donation and living a heart and renal healthy lifestyle and just telling my story.
And what an incredible story it is, man. I actually do. You just made me think of one follow-up that I would feel remiss to not ask you about. But you mentioned, you know, it's these donated organs and people's willingness to donate them that have given me the borrowed time that I have, something to that effect. Do you have a sense? Is there a life expectancy for you that's different than the average male at 31 going on 32, given what you've been through? Or when you talk about that donated time, how specific an idea do you have of what that is?
Yeah, so, you know, most people, just to sum it up, you know, most people think that transplant is a cure. And while transplant is an amazing way, it's more of a treatment, because it's inevitable that I will need another transplant at some point down the road. The odds are getting better and better in my favor because of medicine evolving. You know, they're working on so many great things. They're in the process of, you can actually, there's studies and trials of growing your own kidney inside from stem cell research and things. So there's so many fascinating things that are happening. It's just a matter of getting it through the process and the loops and getting it cleared. And so being where I am at now, they're giving me, you know, with the kidney, the life expectancy of at least another 25 years with the same kidney. With the heart, it's roughly between between 15 and 20. But I have so many people that I'm now, you know, in my support networks via the heart and kidney Facebook groups, support groups through my hospital and things, that I just met a guy the other day who he's 29 years out with the same heart. So it's not the numbers. It's just being compliant with the docs, taking the meds, yeah, and living the lifestyle that you need to, and advocating and realizing that it's about self-care and taking care of you first, because if money can fix it, it's not a problem. So everything else can come later.
Absolutely. And you know, I guess in some way, living your whole life with a chronic condition and having to learn about self-care and the importance of that since you were a baby, essentially, only serves you now that you have, you know, these additional self-care practices to be mindful of. But that's good to know. That's good to hear. And it's good to hear how medicine and the evolving medicine is just changing that prospect all the time. Mike, you're an inspiring dude. And, you know, we don't know each other well, but I'm proud to be in a community you belong to. I'm proud to have you as somebody that I can reference when people ask about hemophilia and what's possible and challenges. You have an incredible story. You have an amazing amount of energy and enthusiasm for the work that you're doing. It's important work. Keep doing it. And anything that updates that you have that you want people to know about, you have our email addresses here. Shoot us emails. We'll send links out through, you know, our network so that listeners can keep up with your story. And Mike's website, I just had it pulled up here, newheartformike.com, right, Mike? Is that, and it's the number four, newheartformike.com, and that'll also give you links to your social channels and other ways of getting in touch with you are on that website too, Mike?
Yes. Yeah, everything. Everything is on there. My Instagram, because I love to take, you know, pictures of my food. I'm a huge food porn guru. So, yeah, check out everything there is. I'll have you drooling by the time you get done watching those Instagram stories.
Sounds like a challenge. All right, go find Mike on Instagram again, newheartformike.com. Mike, thank you very much, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Definitely. Thank you very much, and it was an honor being on your podcast.
Pleasure's mine, man. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, Natalie, we're going to play a little game. It's called Word Association. I'm going to say a word, and then you tell me the first word that comes to mind. Ready? Pizza.
Shire.
Monkey.
Shire.
Tabletop.
Shire.
The Bloodstream Podcast.
Shire.
The Bloodstream Podcast is made possible by Shire, and for that, we say...
Thank you, Shire.
Thanks, Shire. Thanks again, Mike, for coming on the Bloodstream Podcast. I hope you all enjoyed hearing some of Mike's inspiring story. His energy, I know I said this at the end of the interview, is very impressive to me. You can hear the enthusiasm and the energy and the determination in his voice. And I guess you'd have to own those things if you're going to be somebody who learns that your life's in jeopardy, drops 280 pounds, gets a heart transplant, a kidney transplant, sets new goals in life. Like, I guess you have to have that level of enthusiasm and determination to make those things happen. But learn more about Mike at newheart4mike.com, the number four, newheart4mike.com. Com. You can find him on Facebook as well. If you put that in the Facebook search bar, it'll bring you to his Facebook page. All right, last segment before we wrap up our February episode. It's always such a sad moment, but here we are with parting shots. One last thought to leave the audience with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise, Natalie Rose DeLilla Lynch. Natalie Rose DeLilla Lynch, what is your parting shot for February?
My parting shot is feel lucky that I got to be the first human to see Bombardier Bloom.
Ha ha ha, that is true. You are the other than Stephen and I, the editor and I, you are the first human being to see it.
And I loved it. And I'm excited for the world to see it. And you're going to have a pretty decent sized audience eyes on it this week. Or
yeah.
you just, after this, when this is released, you'll have
just happened. We're doing a little pre-screening for some people for notes and feedback in just a few days. It'll have just gone by the time this comes out.
Yeah, so it's excellent, and I'm really proud of you and the Believe team and Chris, and it's a cool
project.
Not to give anything away, but my eyes weren't dry.
Yeah, I think if we're successful, people's eyes shouldn't be, so good. Well, thank you for that.
And what's yours? What's your parting shot?
My parting shot is kind of, feels a little bit obligatory. So EHAD, the European Association for Hemophilia and Allied Disorders, just had their annual conference, whatever they're calling it, but their annual get together, present data and talk about bleeding disorders meeting in Madrid, Spain this past weekend, from the time we're recording this. Obviously, we were not there.
Why don't we go to those? Madrid?
Natalie, we're on planes too much to begin with. obviously I wasn't there. Can't really speak firsthand about the experience there, but I want to recommend to anyone who is interested, for nerds like me who are interested in the takeaways from ASH and EHAD and HFA and NHF and WFH Congress and all these meetings that go on throughout the year. I want to let you know, you can find, if you go to Twitter and look up the hashtag EHAD2018, so that's EAHAD2018, hashtag EAHAD2018,
you're giving a Wi-Fi password.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to do it rhythmically so people remember it. That's probably somebody's Wi-Fi password out there. Maybe it was the Wi-Fi password at EHAD2018, who knows? Sponsored by somebody. Take a look. There were some interesting things that came out of it. Nothing that seemed, particularly popping, which is why I didn't mention anything previously in this episode. But I do think it's good to kind of generally keep an eye on news and updates. And there's some pretty great people who contribute to the bleeding disorders Twitterverse. And I do think Twitter is one of the better places to get updates from conferences. So one last time, EAHAD2018, hashtag on Twitter for updates from EHAD 2018. And that is all for this episode. Check out bloodstreammedia.com and subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast, Ask the Expert, the Powering Through Podcast, and the Bloodline Podcast to hear all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community, now available on Spotify. You can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. This episode of the Bloodstream Podcast was written by Patrick James Lynch and Natalie Lynch, produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Gielen, Rob Bradford, Josh Bragg, Ava Friedman, Heather Robin, Colby Crow, and edited by Michael Capuano of Ice Men Audio. Special thanks to everybody at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and of course, Shire. Thanks as well to Share segment contributor Heather Lutz and sit-down guest Michael Hargett. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself.